Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast that we started to try and encourage people to talk a bit more about death and dying, and also to talk about how to get on with your life if you've suffered a big loss. And I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Bill Webster, who's a grief counsellor, an expert on all things to do with death and dying. He gives talks and he publishes books. Dr. Bill, and he's from Canada, so he's all the way over here in the UK. I'm thrilled to meet you. Thank you so much.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me to participate in the podcast.
Would you like to start by telling me your story and why it was you got involved in this area of work?
Absolutely, I'd be delighted. Well, while I've lived in Canada for almost 50 years, I'm actually Scottish, and I come over every year to brush up on my accent. But I was born and raised in Arbroath, which is on the east coast of Scotland. Went to university in Glasgow and went to university in London. It was there I met Carolyn, who was a Canadian girl, and we got together, and she actually went to Canada in my final year, and I had to finish my degree and so on. So we wrote letters, these little blue airmail letters, which we used to do. And I went out to Canada with a view to being married out there and coming back. But then the door opened up for me to stay there, and it was quite wonderful. And we had two boys, and Andrew and Steve, and we thought we were going to live happily ever after. But sadly, in 1983, only after 11 years of marriage, Carolyn died very suddenly and quite unexpectedly of a heart attack.
She was young.
Very young, yes. And no history of heart problems. It was just quite unexpected, instant. Well, it just threw me for a loop.
Not surprised.
I couldn't believe it. The problem was, that was the problem. I couldn't believe it. And so when we had the funeral and people would come and to the service and so on, I actually ended up comforting everybody else. And people seeing that said, oh, you're strong, you're doing so well. But in fact, it wasn't that I was strong, I was numb. I was in shock. So I got through the time of the funeral beautifully. Everybody said, oh yes, he's doing well. I think they were quite relieved because it wasn't going to be as big a problem as people thought. So I threw myself into the task of being a single dad. But the problem was that 3 months after Carolyn died, the numbness wore off and I began to experience what I can only express as an explosion of feelings and emotions and confusion and anxiety and crying and yearning, that's an often over mislooked, longing for her to come back, pleading that she would come back, which of course is not going to happen. But 3 months after Carolyn died, it actually felt 1,000 times worse than it had the day she passed away. Mm. And so I thought, is this right? You know, am I doing it right? Am I losing my mind? This just didn't seem possible, because at that point, people would actually say to me, well, Bill, it's been 3 months. You ought to be over it by now. So you were doing so well at the time of the funeral. What's wrong with you? So I learned very quickly, as many grieving people do, when people asked me how I was, I'd smile politely and say, oh, I'm fine, thank you. And then I'd cry alone at night. Mm. People thought I should be getting myself together, but I felt like my heart had been ripped right out of my chest. And so I sought some help from a friend of mine who was a psychotherapist, and he helped me work through some of the things. And he said, but you should use this story to help others. And so I went back to university. I did my doctorate at the University of Toronto and persuaded them to allow me to do it in grief support and in understanding grief, because there was nothing in the universities at that point. There were no grief counselors, there were no support groups. And I did that, and part of my work was developing a model of community grief support, and which I'm very happy to say in the last 25, 30 years or so has become a national program in Canada, and it's used quite widely here in the UK, which I feel is a great privilege. And so after 25, 30 years of being a so-called expert, having written books and having done seminars and talks on grief and helping people through grief. In 2018, my son was killed in an accident. And again, that just threw me for a loop. People expected, because I was a grief counselor, because I was a professional, that I knew all about grief, I knew the theory, I would just take it in stride. It knocked the legs right out from under me. And so I found myself in another grief process and going through the same emotions, but different, because it was a different time in my life. It was my son, not my wife. And there's no such thing as one neat, orderly way to describe grief, because everybody's experience is different. So that's what got me into grief counseling. And after 2018, I thought, oh, I don't think I can do this anymore. And then I thought, no, wait a minute. I have to do something. A, because, you know, I now had another aspect of my story. And B, because that's what Steve would have wanted me to do. He would have said, Dad, don't give up. And so that motivated me to, you know, try and lift my program to a different level and so on. So that's a little bit of how I got to be where I am today.
So are you telling me that your second experience of grief, despite all your knowledge and expertise and experience in the area, nothing helped you?
No, I'm not quite saying that. What I'm saying is there's no such thing as more or less difficult. It's just different. So the loss of my wife in when I was still in my 30s, and the loss of Steve, now that the age that I am, and he was 42 years old when he died, it was quite different, a very different experience. And I think that we need to understand that it's there's no cookie cutter method to this. Everybody goes through what they need to go through, and there are so many factors like the time of life, the relationship that's been lost. Because even if three people lose a spouse, nobody knows how anybody else feels, because there are relationships and relationships. And so that made that grief process unique. And so I always, in fact, that's what makes my work so exciting. Every person I meet can teach me something else about grief, because everybody's experience is different.
And I think the worst thing about the situation that we're both in and that you spend your time in is other people's expectations, isn't it, really? Nobody wants us to be in a bad place. They all want us to be better. And people don't seem to have the patience to understand what you've just said about everybody's grief being different and each person needing a different approach.
I think that's right. I mean, everybody would like to fix it. And the problem is it can't be fixed. But I think that the deeper problem, to be honest, is that after 3 months, people's lives have moved on. Their world hasn't changed, their world goes on. But when we have a bereavement, the only way to understand bereavement is realizing that your entire world has changed. You're seeing everything through different eyes. And I don't think people understand that, because there's a fundamental misunderstanding about grief. We see it as a disease or a sickness or something that we need to get over. But in fact, it's a healing process. It's always an unwelcome journey, but it's a healing process. And I think I'm concerned sometimes that people don't have the patience to go through it. And people, no indictments on anybody, but people not understanding what the grief is trying to do and how long it takes to get through the journey become a little bit worry about us when 3 months later we're not doing as well as they would like us to see us being. But that says more about them than it does about us, because it's basically saying, we would like to see you back to normal. And the information that they need is, we're not going back to normal, we're different, we've changed. And hopefully you can support that person in their new journey.
And that's the word we need to spread, really, isn't
exactly.
it? And yet people don't seem to want to talk about it until it happens to them.
Well, and even after it happens to them, many people don't talk about it because they're not encouraged to. I mean, people sort of say, well, you know, let's not mention the person's name. Let's not bring up the subject because so-and-so is just going to get upset. But I always say to grieving people, the only thing that upsets people is when people don't talk about it, because we don't want our loved ones to be forgotten. I don't want Steve to be forgotten. I don't want Carolyn to be forgotten. And so I think it's in talking about it, but that we need almost a fundamental shift in people's attitude. People need to understand. And so that's why the first principle of my grief support program, and this will surprise you in the end and the audience, I'm sure, and I'd love to chat about it. I think the first important thing is education, to understand what is grief? Why do we grieve? What is the purpose of this process? It's a healing process, But see, we don't take time to sort of investigate it. We try to push it down and say, oh, I got to get over this. I got to be strong. Because we don't want people to think we're weak. We don't want people to think we're not coping. And so when everybody asks us, how would it? Oh, I'm fine. And then we cry at home alone at night. So that's the dilemma. And I think that's the fundamental shift that needs to happen so that we can become more sympathetic and empathetic towards grieving people.
And how do you think that we should do this education? Do you think we should introduce grief work in schools?
Well, as a matter of fact, John Adams, who is the president of the NAFD, has done some wonderful work. He raised a petition and it was presented to the government, and the government has agreed that death education will now become part of the curriculum in schools in England. 100 years ago, everybody talked about death, but nobody talked about sex. Yeah. Look how things have changed, because children get sex education. I'm not sure if that's the appropriate, and forgive me if it's not the appropriate way to describe it, but children get those lessons, and yet we don't talk about death. But I also think that sex is on the media all the time. But we need to change that and put, you know, loss. I don't think it's just death. I think it's loss. People grieve when they have a loss. And a loss is defined as when you're deprived of something or someone who is of value to you. So, yes, death, someone dies. But the loss of health, the loss of a job, the loss of financial security, the loss of a home. And how many life losses are there that people grieve? Because grief is a natural reaction to a loss. So we've been developing some programs which we're putting on social media and so on, short videos on coping with loss in the workplace, for example, coping with the loss of a pet, and many other losses. Loss leads to grief, but it doesn't always lead to mourning, because there's a big difference between grief and mourning. In the language, we use it almost synonymously. Oh, you're grieving, you're mourning. They're actually polar opposites. Grief is how you feel after a loss. Mourning is how you express those feelings and those emotions. And so dilemmas, I'm sure you can see. Everybody grieves. From the moment of birth, we grieve because of a loss. And we grieve all of us. It's inherent. But mourning is a learned behavior. So when we look at other cultures, many other cultures have rituals and grieving and 3 days doing this. But we've lost a lot of that in our culture here in the UK and in Canada and North America. Because so often people have just a cremation and then do nothing. But I really believe that grief has to lead to action. Grief is resolved by actions. Everybody thinks about it, everybody feels it, but what do we do about it? And I think that's an important key that can be missing in many experiences.
What kind of actions?
Having a funeral, doing a ritual, a celebration of life, mentioning the person's name, talking about them. I mean, what is a ritual? A ritual is something you do when you don't know what to do or when there's nothing to do. So it can be anything. It doesn't have to be religious, it doesn't have to be secular, it doesn't have to be anything other than do something, even if it's going to the grave and placing flowers, or even if it's having a memorial service or having a birthday party on the person, what would have been the person's birthday. Everybody's going to have their own view, and everybody has the right to make their own choice. It's not sort of a nice, now you must do this and so on. Do something, do anything. And you'll find that that will help you to begin to reconcile what has happened and come to terms with it.
Going back to what you were saying earlier on about loss, I think one of my most impressionable recordings was with a youngish man, well, he's in his mid-40s, I would guess, who was abandoned by his mother at age 2. Yeah. And of course that led then to a life of anger, mm-hmm. where he did things he shouldn't have done, ended up in prison.
Yeah.
He's now reformed and he employs ex-prisoners, which is
wonderful. Isn't that wonderful?
In his business.
That's wonderful.
But that's the kind of thing you're talking about, isn't it? Loss doesn't have to be by death.
You know what? That's a lovely story, and it raises a very important point. People not only grieve what they've lost, they also grieve what they never had. And that explains why a child may have been adopted at birth, for whatever reason. 20, 25 years later, they want to find out who was my birth mother, who was my father, what's my heritage and stuff. And they discover that their mother has died, and they grieve over someone that they didn't know, they never knew. And why? It's because they longed for that relationship. And when they have discovered that they never had it and they're never going to have it, grief is the wreck, because it's a loss.
And the other thing about loss, which I think isn't often mentioned, is the fact that very often, if it's a couple anyway, and you lose a partner, it's a loss of your future, it's a loss of your expectations, a loss of your hopes, and I'm sure the same applies if you lose a child.
Absolutely. When someone dies, it's what's known as a primary loss. But connected to every primary loss are many secondary losses. Now, they're secondary not because they're less important, they're secondary because they emerge out of the initial loss. So the picture that I would suggest would be where someone sets up a row of dominoes or a pattern of dominoes in it, and at the appropriate moment, someone tips over the first domino, and that tips over the next one all the way down the line until they've all fallen over. And I think that's often what people experience. Someone dies, and it's the loss of a relationship. It might be the loss of financial security. It might be the loss of a home. It might be the loss of companionship, the loss of someone to care for me when I get older. Just there are so many different life losses that are experienced as a result of the loss. And again, I don't think many people recognize or acknowledge or validate the significance of these losses.
And one of the other interviews I've spoken to recently talks about the loss of intimacy, which is
absolutely
swept under the carpet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You see, because, and I think that's very true. On one of my videos, I asked a gentleman, and he very bravely talked about that. And he said, people think it's all about the sex. But it's not about the sex, it's about the intimacy, the caring. It's about, you know, someone that can hug me and hold me and that I know is showing care and affection for me. And we miss that. And the difficulty is, oh, now we're going to get into it. And I think particularly with men often try to replace that and discover very quickly that it can't be replaced. The person cannot be replaced. They have to develop a new relationship. You met my wife, Joanna, this morning, and I was actually on my own for 10 years. I brought up my two boys, and I didn't feel I wanted to introduce a new mother. And Joanna wasn't a new mother. You know, she 10 years later she came into my life, and I think it's very important to say that I really do believe in that we can have new relationships and all that kind of stuff. But it's difficult when people get into it too quickly, because then they have two people in the present. And I've seen people who've jumped very quickly into another marriage, and it's been difficult. I had to get to the place where I realized that Carolyn was in the past and Joanna was in the present. And it's actually a Freudian concept called decathexis, cutting the strings, cutting the ties. Not that we say, and then they float off like a helium balloon into the ether, never to be seen or thought of again. No. Carolyn will always be a part of my life. Michael will always be a part of your life, but it's in the past. And it's when you feel that you want to enter a new relationship that would be in the present, never the twain shall meet. I've been doing grief group. Joanne and I have been married for 30 years now. And I go out every day or every evening and do groups where I talk about another woman. Can you imagine? And Joanne is my biggest supporter, because she realizes Carolyn's in the past. It's not a threat. She's in the present, and hopefully in the future as well.
I'm fascinated that you brought up the subject of particularly men, because again, yeah, that's something we don't talk about very often, but it's so often the case, isn't it, that a man will find a new woman very quickly, whereas women hang on to what they've had.
Well, I think that's right. I think, at the risk of alienating all my male listeners here, I think often, if you think about it, men and women have their own particular areas of expertise. But when a man loses a spouse, maybe this was someone, and I don't mean to be sexist here, but you know, sometimes wives look after the men when the, in the little things. You know, Michael, one of the fellows in my video, talks about how he'd go to work and everything would be the same as it always was. And then he'd come home. And no aroma of supper in the oven, nobody to welcome, ask him how he got on that day and all this kind of stuff. And I think it's these little things that we miss that were in the relationship that is no longer there. And so there's no question in my mind that males respond differently than women and females to grief, but I think that's conditioning.
So you're saying that men kind of need women, whereas women don't need men?
No, I'm not saying that. No, you're going to get me in real trouble here. No, I'm not. But I think that they need each other in different ways. Right. I'm sure you needed your husband, I needed my wife, but maybe it was in different ways. And again, not to put people in the traditional roles. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I think that it's different.
I think my opinion, I may be completely wrong about this, but I just have a feeling that because women are kind of inherently more sociable, they find it easier to get on without a partner, whereas a man perhaps is a little bit less inclined to go out on his own, so looks for a substitute.
That's a very wise thing to do, because even if you listen to male and female conversations, women start talking about, so this is what happened, and men say, so, you know, how about the Chelsea Football Club, or how about the cricket team, or whatever. And men tend to talk on that level, whereas I think women tend to be a little bit more, social and intimate and the things of the heart.
More in touch with emotions.
Yes, that's a very good way to describe
but we're
it.
We're both going to be in terrible trouble now for being making well, huge generalisations.
I'm going back to Canada in a couple of weeks. I'm sorry for you.
I can't let you go. We're nearly at the end, but I always ask everybody, and I'm sure you'll be able to help with this, what are the best things when you know that somebody in your neighbourhood, one of your friends or your neighbours or relation, has been recently bereaved?
Yep.
The best things to do and say and the things not to do and say.
Well, the best thing to do is to listen. Because I think what helpers can do best is to create an environment where the person will want to talk. And I think that's by invitation. Would you like to talk? And if they feel that, you know, they can be trusted, sometimes I find that just sharing a little bit of my story, well, I remember how I felt when my wife died and my son died. Because grieving people have one question and one question only, and it's this: do you have any idea what I'm going through? And if we can validate that and convince them of that, to talk about them. What I often do is I try to ask people first of all about the life, not about the death. I don't go in and say, so tell me what happened. Because when people asked me that when Steve died, I thought, you're just being curious. You know, you're not being compassionate, you're being curious. I may have been wrong, but that's how I felt. So I appreciated the fact that people said, tell me the things you did together. Tell me some of your best memories. Tell me what he was like. You know, what kind of things did he enjoy and so on? Because I think we have to put the death in the context of the life. Yes, this person has died, but they also lived. And that's what's really important. And finding out about the life will inevitably lead into conversations about the death. I think it's very important that we try to help people develop the habit of having conversations around this topic. There's a saying that I sometimes use that says, anything that is mentionable is manageable. And so when we can talk about it, when we can mention it, someone else has once said, you're only as sick as your secrets. And so if we keep it a secret and we don't talk to anybody about it, it festers. So I think the best thing we can do is to befriend someone. Can we go for a coffee? You know, an invitation. And to be patient. And if they say, no, I don't want to talk about it, well, that's fine, maybe next time. And to keep going. And finally, the person will say, yeah, I guess you really are interested, not just curious. And they'll open up, because Grieving people want to talk. They just want to know that they're not going to be criticized, that people aren't going to tell them that something wrong or whatever, and so acceptance and so on. There's many things that we can do. So often we say to people, if there's anything I can do to help, don't hesitate to let me know. Nobody's ever going to ask that. Nobody's ever. So, can I do this for you? Well, what's the this? Someone will say, well, figure it out. What would this elderly person who doesn't have a car need to get to the doctor's appointment, to get grocery shopping? What would this elderly gentleman need? So often people bring casseroles and food and stuff, and that's wonderful for a little while. But the biggest thing that someone did for me when it came to Christmas, I said, I've never done a turkey before. This lady and her husband came over and taught me how to cook a turkey. From then on, I was on my own, and it was wonderful. So I think sometimes when we do things, it's better to do things with people than to do things for people. Because if you do it with them, you empower them. Whereas if you do it for them, they'll sit back and say, oh, this is wonderful. Let's do that again. Please, can you please come over? And you've got a full-time job. So just a few of these things. But be natural is really the best I can say. Be yourself. Because you are the gift. You are the gift. It's not what you say. There's a famous saying by Maya Angelou, who is a wonderful poet, part of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And Maya Angelou once said, people will not remember what you say or do. They will only remember how you made them feel. So people aren't going to remember what you say. So don't worry about it. People aren't even going to remember what you do. They'll just remember how you made them feel. Focus on that and you can't go wrong.
Wonderful words of wisdom, Dr. Bill. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.